Blog Talk Radio.
Second Book Nook podcast, and we're talking about Star Trek Discovery, Drastic Measures, Book 2. And if that opening theme song wasn't enough to put you into some Discovery talk, I don't know what is. I'm your host, Uncle Jim, and with me as usual is my co-host. We'll start off with Charles. He's out in Las Vegas. How you doing tonight, Charles?
I'm doing good. We're getting another heat wave coming through, so enjoying the air conditioning.
Yeah, it's hot here in Vermont, too. We have a heat index of 90-plus till midnight tonight, which is unheard of for Vermont. So we're feeling it, too. We're feeling it, too. And we also have with us Eric. Eric is out in Portland. How you doing tonight, Eric?
Well, I am doing okay, and we are feeling the heat out here as well. It might have hit 100 or maybe 99 or so out here. So not quite Las Vegas level, but hot enough to make me pretty uncomfortable and want to hang out in the basement.
Yeah, it's hot everywhere. So our phone number here, guys, is 646-668-2433. That's 646-668-2433. We have with us live in the studio with us tonight, Dayton Ward, the author of the Star Trek Discovery book, Drastic Measures. How you doing tonight, Dayton?
I'm doing great. How are you guys doing?
We're doing pretty good. Thank you very much for joining us tonight.
No, happy to be here.
So if you guys have a question for Dayton, please give us a call. We are definitely going to be talking about Discovery. We have a lot to talk about Discovery, particularly this awesome book, Drastic Measures. But before we do that, there's something else that we would like to talk a little bit about, and that would be the Star Trek Klingon expansion core book called Klingon. Are you allowed to talk about that?
I think so. It's been released, right? There's a PDF out there that people can download. So, yeah, I'll give it a go.
Yeah, the PDF is out. The hardbound hasn't come out yet.
Yeah, the PDF is out, but not the actual book.
Right, but that's good enough. We can talk. We'll see what happens.
Yeah, I don't want to get in trouble or anything, so being a Klingon fan. So how did you get involved with Modiphius and writing a Klingon book?
Well, I was approached by Jim Johnson, who's the line editor, the guy who's in charge of procuring all this stuff. And this has been a few years ago, back when the game was still in its development stages. And I, working with another writer, Scott Pearson, and Jim, we developed the whole the premise for the living campaign, the Shackleton Expanse, and the story that drives that part of the that takes place in that area of space. So we laid out a premise and we created several story prompts and other ideas that were posited that the game designers and other people who were writing adventures could run with. And then they proceeded to roll this thing out as part of the living campaign. And I was pretty much done with it at that point. That was, a couple of years ago. And then, last year, Jim reached out and asked me if I was interested in doing some more material for the game. So we are doing, you know, it ended up being material I wrote for the Klingon core rule book. And as it happens, another book that they briefly announced a couple of weeks ago, there's an expansion or a supplement book that is devoted to the Shackleton Expanse and the Living Campaign, including, you know, providing a conclusion for that storyline. So I've been kind of busy with Modiphius now for the last several months, in and among other things.
Now, is this a new game, or is this just an expansion where you can actually take a Klingon and build a house, and, you know, like you did with the Federation?
It's sort of the best of both. I think it's its own animal. It's a core rule book, so all the rules are there. And in fact, I think they've gone in and tweaked some of the rules from the original core rule book to kind of clarify or tighten gameplay. But you basically, the entire game is presented as if you want to generate Klingon characters and carry out adventures as Klingon characters instead of Starfleet and Federation types. So yeah, it can either be its own self-contained role-playing game, or you can add it into what you already do with the core rulebook for the basic game.
Excellent. So I can actually start with a Klingon, and I can go right through my training, pick my, just like
yep.
you do with your Federation officer, Batliff training and all that stuff, and go right through.
Everything is in there as it would pertain to Klingons. So all the rules and all the skills and abilities and all the things you have to generate and develop are done from a Klingon, or, you know, as a Klingon point of view. So yes, go for it.
Wow, excellent. I'm looking forward to getting my hands on the book. Now, as far as the rules go, is it also like a handbook that talks about the Klingons, like an information book as well? Like on the different houses, the different ships, the different weapons, the different races and things of that nature? Like a source book?
It's presented, yeah, it's basically a core source book. So it presents all that information the same way that the original core rulebook does from the Federation side of things. So you get Klingon history, you get Klingon culture, how the military works, how fleets work, and how landing parties work. Or boarding parties work, and what the Klingon Empire's relationship with the different interstellar powers is, but it's all done from their point of view, not Starfleet database or Federation database. It's all Klingon centric. So it's like, how do the Klingons look at the Romulans, and how do the Klingons look at the Gorn and the Federation and all the other interstellar powers? So everything is juiced in that direction.
Wow, I cannot wait to get my hands on that book. I'm so excited for that book. Charles, did you have any questions about the Klingon book?
No, but I've played a couple of different times with Star Trek Adventures. The problem is we usually get the DM who's caught up with real life. We don't get very far in the game. But I've loved all the books they put out, the adventures they put out. And when they announced this Klingon one, I thought, oh, they're doing the addendum. Then I heard details on it. I was like, no, they're doing a second core book. It's like, even if I don't play the game, I love the book for the resources. The three division books were fascinating to read through, just the details that are in those books. I've already got the book on pre-order from my local game shop. It's like, okay, you guys get it. I want one of the copies. I got to have the book.
I look at it the same way. I don't actually get to play the game that much, but I love the care and detail that went into these source books. And so I keep it as a reference guide for
other
stuff that I do.
The details you took to build a character. I love the fact that you send a character through a full life path.
Oh, well,
unlike
let me
just roll a character up.
Let me be the first to say I had nothing to do with that.
No, but I'm just saying just the life path was great in that series. I can't wait to see the life path in Klingon.
I'm sure you'll be suitably impressed. I cannot take credit for any of that. That is not my skill set. That is, you know, that's Nathan Dowdell and all the other game designers at Modiphius who did that. So I absolutely do not want to divert any credit from them. I am strictly my role in the book was strictly as background material. So I wrote about culture and the military organizations and the relationships between the Empire and other powers, that was where I came into play. As far as the game mechanics and how you generate the characters, that is strictly people who actually know what they're doing in that regard.
Well, I'm still looking forward to your part also, because the history and then all those details are going to be fascinating as well.
Oh, it's incredible. The amount of attention to detail that goes into these books and in this game has continued to impress me since I first heard about it. It's really something. And that's a testament to Chris and Sam and Jim and all the other folks at Modiphius.
Yeah. Well, Modiphius has got some pretty good IPs right now.
I agree. Okay, I agree.
Let me ask you a question. Something that I've always wondered, something that's not bothered me, but something that's been in the back of my mind ever since I saw the movie, being a Klingon fan that I am, what happened to the Klingon Empire after Praxis exploded and Kronos got infected and they had to evacuate the planet? That's never addressed on the Next Generation. They just say, here's Kronos, but actually it's not. It's like Kronos 2.0, because Kronos got damaged beyond livability after Star Trek VI. So do you bring that up in the book, in the history of the Klingon Empire at all?
I don't know. I don't remember it offhand if that's in there. I think that's one of those things about, you know, it's like the Yati, yet another Trek inconsistency, Y-A-T-I. I don't know that they've ever actually fleshed out the, you know, how to deal with the disparity. What happened to the Klingon homeworld? I believe basically we have conceded the idea that somehow the Federation came in and helped restore the atmosphere, or, you know, cure the problem that was caused by Praxis to allow the homeworld to remain habitable or return it to habitability. I don't know that it's ever actually been spelled out and all those dots were connected that explicitly, but that seems to be the conceit. Because you never hear them talk on Next Generation or any other later shows that, okay, we're on the, you know, the second version of the Klingon homeworld. That never actually comes up in dialogue. They just kind of wink and nod and move on. It's kind of the same reason that, you know, blood is pink in Star Trek VI, but it's not in other productions. I think we just sort of wink and wink and keep moving with the storyline and hope nobody really pauses long enough to take it apart.
Yeah, I often wonder that myself. Not that it's a big deal. It's not that I'm going to hate on Star Trek for it. I'm not that type of fan. But, you know, Picard dealt with the destruction of the Romulan homeworld after the supernova. That was a big part of Picard. And they never really, I think they missed an opportunity to address the Klingon Federation relationship with Praxis. And that's something that I feel has always been missing. And I was hoping maybe it was covered in this book a little bit to fill in a little bit of those holes for Klingon fans like me that were wondering. But I'm still going to buy the book. Don't worry.
it's entirely possible it's in there, and I've just failed to know that, because the way the book was put together, I was in my silo writing what Jim asked me to write. And I have yet to actually flip through a completed copy of the book. So I don't know what all's in there. I only got to see the parts that I wrote. So for all I know, you know, there's a big poster in there saying Dayton sucks on page 291, and they're waiting for me to find it. So,
one more quick question, and then I will turn the mic over to Eric. We've seen different Klingons now, which again is not an issue for me, but it is for a lot of fans. So, in this book, do you guys address the different races of Klingons and why Discovery has Egyptian-looking type sarcophagus ships, and then all of a sudden they change to the TOS classic-looking ships at all?
Modiphius at present does not have a license to do anything that ties into Discovery or Picard or any of the new shows that are in development. Their license strictly covers what I have taken to calling Legacy Trek, so original series through Enterprise and the feature films before the JJ movies. So no, there's nothing about Discovery or their version of the Klingons or anything like that in this volume. If Modiphius gets the license to do products that tie into Discovery, I suspect that we will see an addendum to this book or a source book update or something like that. I think that's what FAFSA used to call it, was a source book update, you know, where they added in new information every time there was a new movie. That's how far back I go, because I bought that stuff new. So I just dated myself horribly right there. But
didn't we all, though?
Yeah, exactly. But I expect it'll be, you'll see something like that. There'll be a Klingon or a Discovery-centric update that will let you plug those elements into the game.
That would be great. And Eric, I've been Charles and I have been hogging up all of Dayton's time, so I think it's only fair that we give you an opportunity to ask a question if you'd like to about the Klingon source book.
Absolutely. I'm really interested in how all of this information gets assembled. It sounds like somebody comes to you and says, I need you to write something on this particular topic. Do you have kind of a store of resources on how to construct all of that? Do you have any artistic levity, or is it all sort of brought to you and you're responsible for crafting it? I'm really curious about that part of it.
First of all, Jim Johnson, the line editor, is the one who is overseeing the effort, or as I like to call it, herding the cats. And he assigned us different chapters or segments of chapters for the throughout the book. And so I actually hopscotched through the book with the material that I was asked to write. So like a part of it will be in chapter 2 and another part will be in chapter 3, or there are sidebars that get sprinkled throughout the book, depending on where they are appropriately set. Jim is the one who assembled all of that. And I believe he had some help with Scott Pearson, who serves basically as a continuity and canon editor for the entire line. So anything that gets done for the game, whether it's a rule book or a source book or an adventure, goes past Scott for consistency and making sure it all sticks with the canon. And then Jim is the one who puts it all together. As far as what I was given to write, I was given very broad, bullet points. Like I'd like so many words that deal with the Klingon military, and so many words that deal with military training or the history of the Empire, for example. And so I just go to work. I go flesh out that material based on what we know from the television episodes and the feature films. If there's already been some lore established in one of the other books for the game, I might draw on that. If I have a chance, I'll make a wink and a nod and a salute to some other iteration of Star Trek game or other fictional resource, like a novel or something. If I think I can slide it in and it won't upset anybody, I'll do that. And then the rest of it, you just sort of make up and extrapolate from what we know. Excellent. And then Jim gets to put it all together.
Yeah. I mean, his job is, I understand, as the master crafter, but it's nice that you get to throw in your own sort of 2 cents, so to speak, every now and then there too. Well, I'm really looking forward to the book. I also don't really play the game.
I think we're losing you.
I actually don't play the game, but this book sounds pretty good, so I definitely plan on picking up a copy.
Yeah, any Klingon fan definitely should have a copy. So, our phone number here, guys, is 646-668-2433. We're currently talking with Dayton Ward. We're talking about the new Klingon core/sourcebook for Star Trek Adventures by Modiphius, but we're about to move on to a topic that I think a lot of people are really interested in, Star Trek Discovery. So, Dayton, they just dropped the date on us finally. So it looks like starting next week when Lower Decks hits, we're going to have continuous Star Trek all the way through until January 13th, is it?
Or 7th.
Something like that. 7th.
Isn't it?
Yep.
Many weeks.
Isn't that insane that we're going to have that much Star Trek coming?
Awesome.
One insane, right after right? another. It's the golden age of Star Trek. It is. It really, really is. So I'm really excited about it. So let me ask you, have you seen anything for Lower Decks, and what do you think about that, since we're going to be seeing that first?
Well, I've seen the same minute and a half clip that you have.
You don't have any inside information?
I have all sorts of inside information. I just can't share it with you. I've seen the same hour or minute and a half clip that you all saw, which is basically the teaser or the cold open for the first episode. I think it's a very interesting take on Star Trek. I I'm interested to see how people are going to react to it. I know that it's got people set abuzz for different reasons, and there's panic and uncertainty and odd interest, but I think it's an interesting take. Mike McMahon is a hardcore Star Trek fan, and I think it bleeds through the scripts. I don't know that the trailers have necessarily done, you know, that justice as far as selling the idea that this show is being written by a team of people who are hardcore Star Trek fans. I'm talking deep cut references a mile a minute in every script that I've read so far. There's dialogue, there's sight gags, there's references back to other episodes and other shows. There's connections that actually are relevant to the stories they're telling. It's obviously a much more lighthearted take on Star Trek. I think the way Mike described it was he wanted to write a story about the guy whose job it is to put the color yellow in the replicator when you order a banana or something to that effect. It's basically a very sideways look at Star Trek. So the focus, of course, is on these lower ranking characters who are down in the bowels of the ship, and they have unsung jobs and they're unsung heroes. But, you know, it's anybody who's ever been in the military knows it's the low ranking people who do all the work. You know, they just don't get all the glory. So at least that's my experience. So I'm looking forward to seeing how people react when they get a chance to see an entire episode and not just a clip here or a still image there. It'll be fun to watch. I'll be there and I'll be laughing.
Well, I know we talked about the trailer. We reviewed it when it came out last week. And one of the things that I thought was funny is when I don't know the characters' names yet, but when a lady comes out of the closet and she's swinging the batlet around and cuts the guy's leg and she says, "I got it from an old Klingon with an eye patch." And the first thing I thought was, oh, she's talking about Chang. He's the only Klingon I can think of with an eye patch because Martok just had one eye. So it had to be General Chang that she got that from, I'm thinking. So
I don't know. I guess we'll find out when the episode airs.
Yeah.
I don't want to spoil anything for you guys.
We loved it.
Yeah. I think it's fun. I think it's just it's a little bit lighthearted. It doesn't take itself so seriously, which I'm a hardcore fan. Don't get me wrong. I love my Star Trek to be, action adventure serious stuff. But I don't mind it when we get to take a little fun or have a little fun with it. Not poke fun at it, but have fun with it. So I'm interested to see how people react to it. I think it's going to be an interesting night. I know that social media is going to melt, but I'll be there.
Yeah.
One of the things that I think makes Star Trek so special and unique, especially right now, is that there's something in Star Trek for everybody. Maybe you don't like Discovery. Maybe you don't like Picard. Maybe you don't like Voyager. Maybe you don't like Lower Decks. But there's something there for everybody. And I think that's one of the strengths that Star Trek has, you know? There's something there for everybody.
I like to think that. I like to think that Star Trek as a premise and a format is robust enough to allow different takes on the material. And even Roddenberry himself advocated for that years ago. He thought there'd be a time after he had passed that Star Trek would be continuing and other people would develop it and lend their talents and their perspectives to it. And it would be this thing that he might not even recognize, doing things that he never even imagined you could do with the format. So I'd like to think that that's what they're doing. I know not everybody's going to like everything, but I don't necessarily like everything that came before, or I liked it to different levels. So but like you said, I think there's something in here for everybody. There's some flavor of Star Trek on or has been on that's for anybody who wants to be a fan.
Well put. That's one of the philosophies of our show here is that there's always something there for everybody, and we can find something positive to talk about anything Star Trek. So that's what we do here. So let's dive right into Star Trek Discovery. You guys ready for some Discovery talk? Because I sure am.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. Let's get it out of the way. I've warmed up, Dayton, enough. Our number here, guys, is 646-668-2433. We're about to talk Discovery, so give us a call and have your questions ready for Dayton. 646-668-2433. We're going to start off with, obviously, you're a Star Trek fan. We know this already. When you wrote the book Drastic Measures, what made you pick Kodos the Executioner as the jumping-off point for this book, or were you told that this is what they want to write about? Where did that come from?
Well, it's an extended answer, so let's see what I can do here.
We have plenty of time.
I was approached by Kirsten Beyer, who's one of the writers on Discovery at the time, and she became the liaison, so to speak, between the show and licensing partners like Simon & Schuster, you know, who does the Star Trek novels, and IDW, who does the Star Trek comics. So we knew there were going to be Discovery novels, and David Mack had already been commissioned to write the first one. She approached me. We're talking middle of 2016. That's how far back we go with this, where we started talking about storylines for the second novel, and she wanted something to be done with Lorca. And the original idea that she had proposed to me was that we would learn the backstory of his previous command, the Baran, and how his crew was lost. And so we would fill in that backstory for Lorca. So once I got NDA'd 16 different times and secrecy agreements, and the ninjas, you know, got me locked in on their assassination schedule if I talked out of turn, I started getting scripts for the show. And so I started reading the first couple of scripts, and I took an immediate liking to Captain Georgiou in the first couple of scripts. And of course, we all know what happens to Captain Georgiou in the first two episodes of Discovery's first season. But I kept, you know, I kept saying I would really like to write something with Georgiou, if not both of Georgiou and Lorca, if possible. So we started bouncing around ideas. I bounced around ideas with Kirsten and my editor at Pocketbooks, Margaret Clark. And I think it was Margaret who hit on the idea of doing the backstory of Talos IV, or not Talos IV, Tarsus IV, and Kodos the Executioner. So we bounced that idea around, and I came up with some things that I thought I could do with that notion. And Kirsten liked it enough to have me go to my corner and write an outline. So I wrote a 16 or 20 page outline laying out the plot of the novel and where I wanted things to go. And I was addressing the questions that she had raised about what she wanted to see the characters do. And once I got the green light, I wrote that. I started writing. I think I started writing early in 2017. We're talking, they had not even cast Lorca yet. Like, we knew who Georgiou was going to be played by, and we knew that, you know, Michael Burnham was going to be played by Sonequa Martin-Green. But I had no idea who was going to play Lorca. And it wasn't until April of 2017 that they cast him, or March of 2017 that they cast him. So by that point, I'd probably written the first 10,000 words of the novel, and then I had to go back in and redo it because I had to change it for Jason Isaacs. In other words, I had to go back and start watching Jason Isaacs and get his mannerisms down and any gestures he might make, or, you know, the way he looks, or the way he squints at the camera, or lowers his voice when he's mad, that kind of stuff. So, and then they told me he was going to be playing, I immediately thought he was going to play him in his native tongue. You know, he's British. So I started writing him that way, kind of like a light version of Picard. And then I find out, no, he's going to play him like a Southern guy from the U.S. And I'm like, well, okay, that changes up things like slang and, you know, expressions when you're mad and that kind of thing. So I went back in and I redid all that, and then kept pressing ahead. And then I finished my manuscript probably around June, I guess, of 2017. And of course, nobody had knew I was doing this. I was secret, you know, I was under the in the cone of silence, as I call it. And so I couldn't say anything. Working on. I couldn't tell anybody I was working on the book, or I had access to materials from the show. They actually kept that under wraps until that year's Star Trek convention in Las Vegas. They made a big announcement where they were going to let me do this. So I finally got to emerge from my cone of silence and talk about the book. And then it didn't come out until the following February. So it was a long process.
Well, you know what I really like about this is that we don't know a lot about Captain Georgiou, but we do know a lot about Mirror Georgiou, and it's just the opposite for Lorca. We really know nothing about Prime Lorca and everything about Mirror Lorca, and here's your book. Here's your book right here with all of that in there. It's just wonderful. I just can't say enough. This book is really good. So when you're writing something like this, were you aware that Lorca was actually the Mirror Lorca and not the Prime Lorca when you wrote this book?
Yes. I knew that's what they were doing with the show, and the story, and you know, because the series premiered in the fall of 2017. So yeah, I knew everything going in. I'd read all the scripts for the first season, and I was aware of all the plot twists. And it made for some entertaining evenings at my house because my wife knew what I was doing. So I'd ask her, you know, and I was deliberately not telling her what was going on in the scripts. I didn't want to spoil it. I didn't want to spoil the show for her. I didn't want to spoil the show for my best friend and my writing partner. I want you guys to be able to watch the show like normal people. But so, you know, week after week, we'd watch the episode and she'd look at me and go, "You knew that was going to happen, didn't you?" And I'm like, "Yeah. Why didn't you tell me?" "Because you asked me not to." You know, we do this every week. So yeah, I knew all the twists. I knew all the spoilers. All right, I was spoiled for the entire season. Yeah, well in advance.
Now, so what about the fortune cookies? When I remember we reviewed all the episodes as they came out on the podcast, and Lorca always had the fortune cookies on his desk there, and he'd always pop them open. So you knew that too. That's why you put the fortune cookies in the book, because you knew that well before we did. Obviously.
Yes, and that's another suggestion from Margaret. Not just the fact that I could reference the fortune cookie, but the specific fortune that plays a part in the story. This is what I think the fortune should read. And we knocked around a couple of alternatives, but I kept coming back to that one. And so I just left it, because I thought it was a great idea. That was another bit of my editor helping me out there.
That was really, I was like, wow. And then what was it like to write young Kirk? There's a scene where
weird.
We actually get to meet Captain. we meet Captain Kirk. Well, not Captain Kirk, but young Kirk. And that was one of the parts in the book that I actually marked that page because I was going to actually read a part of that because I liked it so much. But I won't waste people's time listening to me read it when we have the actual guy that wrote it.
Oh, thank you. I was on the fence about including that cameo. I didn't want to do that too much. I mean, because I know that there are other characters who have appeared in other shows who have been, you know, said to have been on Talos IV. There's even some back and forth about whether Hoshi Sato from Enterprise was on the planet when that happened. But it's not official. It was just some stuff that Mike Sussman wrote for that episode, the Mirror Universe Enterprise episodes, that never actually made it on camera. So I had tinkered with the idea of it, and I almost talked myself out of it. And my editors, I had actually reached out to her and said, "I'm thinking about not doing that cameo." And she said, "No, you got to find a way. You can't have a Talos or a Tarsus IV story and not have Kid Kirk on the planet." So I went back in and reseated. I had it in the outline, but I was thinking about cutting it. But she convinced me to keep it. And the trick was to try to give you a hint of the person that he might become one day, but not lean too far into it. So I opted against the take command of the situation type Jim Kirk, but the adaptable, improvisational Jim Kirk, you know, the guy that can just sort of think on his feet and come up with a quick solution. So I opted for that, you know, and then couched it in the idea of him just being an overzealous teenager.
Well, it worked really, really well. When I got to that part of the book, I actually marked the page and I was like, this is really good because to me, it's not overpoweringly Kirk, but it's Kirk enough to know it's Kirk. And I thought it was perfectly balanced, that part of the book. I really enjoyed it. So, listen, I've talked enough about the book. And I know Eric and Charles have some questions and some things they want to bring up. So how about we jump in here, Eric? Do you have any questions for Dayton about the book? I think you do.
Yeah, absolutely. I've got some ones. I've got one that I'm particularly interested in, but I'm going to save that a little bit. The first thing I wanted to ask about was the arc of the book, which I think is kind of interesting because, you know, the sort of big event that occurs is really towards the front of the book. I think it's in chapter 5 when the big execution, the sacrifice happens. And then the rest of the book is sort of mostly a manhunt. You know, there's a lot of detail thrown in there, a lot of back and forth, a lot of exploring both the Giorgio side of what's going on and the Lorca side of things that's going on. I was just curious about that arc of the book. Was that Was that something that you developed? Did you say, hey, we're going to start with this and the rest of the book is going to be about trying to find this guy? Do you just want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. We talked about how to do that. I mean, and the event has been portrayed various times in different media, whether it's another book or a comic or things of that nature, maybe even a role-playing game supplement. I mean, there are different takes on that event. And I think even in the Captain Kirk autobiography book that came out a few years ago, that was published by Titan Books, touches on it. I think there's a segment of a chapter or a significant portion of a chapter that talks about that period and what happened from Kirk's point of view. So the actual massacre of the colonists has been pretty well played out, in my opinion. I don't know that I could have brought anything different other than just showing it from a different perspective, you know, a different character's perspective. So I opted to kind of get that out of the way, not dispense with it, but use that as the motivating action for the book. And then the rest of the book is showing how the aftermath of the event affects different people in different ways. So, you know, Lorca turns very vengeful, and Giorgio is stressed by the pressures of having to deal with the rescue operation and deal with the planetary government. And they, you know, they butt heads early on and then eventually become allies. So that was what I thought that would be a better platform for fleshing out the two characters and showing how they are different, but yet also have similarities. They just approach their command styles differently. They approach problem solving differently, and they react emotionally in different ways. So that's what I wanted. I didn't want the massacre to be the overshadowing. When's it going to happen? When's it going to happen all through the book? Because we know what happens. It's what happens after that's a big mystery. How he got away, what motivated him to do it, how it affected the colonists, how it affected the rescue people, the rescue operation, the first responders. That's, to me, was the more interesting story.
Well, yeah, and I think that that was probably your sort of leaning into the next thing that I wanted to talk about, which I think is one of the things that people have really picked up on the book, is that there's a great exploration of the sort of justification for the event in Kodos's mind throughout the book, you know, and he keeps kind of coming back to reasons that he's sure that he has done the right thing. And that must take a certain focus to be able to kind of get inside a mind like that could use so many interesting, backflips to sort of justify something so terrible.
Yeah, I don't know what that says about me.
Well, it means you're a good writer, I would assume.
I don't know if that's an indictment or what.
But,
no. First of all, you know, we have to start from the point that what he did is indefensible. There is no justification for what no rational, sane justification for what he did. However, I have always believed that the best villains don't believe themselves to be villains. They believe they are working for some noble purpose that we don't understand, but it's totally makes sense in their head. So they feel they're on the side of right, even though what they're doing is heinous, right? To me, those are more interesting bad guys than just the mustache twirling villain who wants to take over the world because he wants all the money and the Pop-Tarts or whatever the hell that motivates him. I just think it was but the idea and the reason the book is structured the way it is because he literally is trying to convince himself that he did the right thing. He has doubts. He has second thoughts. You know, did I screw this up? And that sort of helps me because the way he is presented in the original series episode, you know, he's lived with this for 20 odd years at this point, and it's affected him emotionally and psychologically, but he somehow found a way to be at peace with it. Even though at the end he comes apart, you know, the end of the episode, he comes apart and talks about it, but he obviously found a way to live with it for the better part of 20 years. So how do you get to that point? How do you justify in your own mind this heinous act? And you're right, it was hard to kind of get in his head because at first I'm like, I don't know what to do. I don't know how to justify this in this guy's mind. There's just no way to do it. So eventually it became a game of him positing questions and exploring theories and maybe not always landing precisely on the correct answer, but it's worth more exploration. So he digs a little deeper. You know, and then we get to the point where it all comes apart and he has to run for his life and that sort of thing.
Well, I just really enjoyed that. So thank you for putting that together.
Thank you.
You know, one of the things that I loved all the little kind of new things that I find out, like this whole, you had this idea for this P-38 skeleton key that's this master key that can open up pressure hatches and, you know, little things like that.
That's funny you say that, because that's actually not something I created for that book. My writing partner, Kevin, we came up with that years ago for we were writing some novellas for a series called Starfleet Corps of Engineers. And so we needed a device, and we've seen the device on TV. You've seen it. It's a thing that Picard will attach to a door, and he squeezes it, and it somehow overrides the pneumatic lock and lets him open the door.
Yeah.
And they never named that thing. They never gave that thing a proper name. So we were casting about, and I came up with the idea of the P-38, because I don't know if anybody's listening who's been in the service, and if they have been, if they've been in a long time ago, there used to be a little can opener that they included in boxes of rations, the canned rations, and it was just a little bitty key that you could hang on your dog tag chain. And it was this marvelous little can opener, and I still carry mine on my key ring, on my keychain to this day, and it's called a P-38. It was an invention of the Army back in World War II, but it's like the coolest thing the Army ever invented, ever. And I've carried one on my key ring and my dog tag chain going back 35 years. So that's where that came from.
Oh, that's fantastic. I love that. Well, so I guess the last thing that I wanted to just ask you about real quick here is perhaps the most mysterious and exciting part of this book that I found, which was way, way, way at the end. It was after all of the, you know, acknowledgments and after your author's page and after all of that stuff, there's this great little elsewhere section where, if we are to interpret things correctly, I think we get a glimpse of Prime Lorca in the mirror universe.
That's a good read on that. That's an excellent read on that.
That's that's what I was hoping to hear.
that scene came about. That was Kirsten Byers' idea. She wanted a hint about the actual fate of Prime Lorca. How that was going to be followed up on was a discussion we were going to have at another time. But I, at the time, I was under the impression that they were seeding a possible idea to be followed up on, whether it's in a book or someplace else. And so she asked me about my thoughts on that, and I thought, that's great. I like that idea. After I get through with the rest of the book and the different wrap-ups, my suggestion was to put it where you find it at the end of the book, like a post-credit scene from a Marvel Cinematic Universe movie. So you get the end of the Avengers, and you sit through the credits for 20 minutes, and there's another scene at the end of it. That's what I wanted. I thought that would be fun. Don't tell anybody about it. Just wait for people to find it or not find it. And I know people who have read the book and told me that they enjoyed the book, and then they come back to me a couple of weeks later and to find out that they had not read that section. They didn't even know it was in there until somebody else pointed it out to them. So I had a little bit of fun of that with that. To my knowledge, that's never been done. At least it's never been done in a Star Trek novel. I don't know if it's been done in any other novels. I mean, there are sections in books where you see a preview of another book or the next book in that series, but I don't know that there's ever been the equivalent of a post-credit scene at the end of a Star Trek novel or any other novel. So
certainly
I had fun with that.
Yeah, certainly first time I've ever seen that. That it was a nice little treat to, you know, actually read it on my Kindle, and so I just kind of kept flipping because I'm one of those geeks that likes to read all the stuff at the end, and I just kept flipping, and then I discovered it. I was like, oh my goodness! And
right. Yeah, why are there so many pages left? I thought I was done. You know, I thought I was
that's
done.
Right. Yeah.
Why is it only 96%?
Right.
in fact, when I that book also got an audiobook adaptation. And so I work with Simon & Schuster Audio when it comes time for the voice artist to come in. In this case, it's Robert Petkoff. And they ask, you know, they send me material for the audiobook adaptation. And basically what they send me is a pronunciation guide to make sure that all the alien names and Trek technology and other terms that I've made up, names that I've made up, I give them the correct pronunciation for those terms. And the question from the producer was, are you sure that you want this section at the very end, like after everything? And I'm like, absolutely. At the very end, the absolute last bit of audio that you record should be that. and it should be at the very end of whatever, the, you know, the credits, the who did this, who read this, any afterword, any acknowledgments, any of that stuff. It should be at the very end. Don't put it forward. And we went back with that a couple of times before they got it to make sure. I'm like, please make sure you do this. You know, yeah, it was fun.
That's fantastic. Well, thank you for that. It was a nice little treat at the end of the book. And speaking of audiobooks, this is a fantastic time for me to pass it over to Charles, who I believe listened to your book instead of read it.
Yes, I've gotten a point now. It's like I go and do my exercise routine for the day, and I pop an audiobook, and away I go. So I actually listened to this book a few weeks ago. Then I was like, okay, the show's coming up. Okay, I'll go back and listen to it one more time. So it's great to just sit there and focus on a great book while I'm sitting there on the treadmill or before walking, getting my exercise. Love the fact that all these books went to audio straight through. One of the things that I thought was interesting in your book was as we were going through the book, we'd stop and say, okay, take a pause. Now we're going to go to an excerpt from the 4000, Crisis on Tarsus IV. And I thought that was interesting to have a book within a book.
Yeah, that was I was looking for a narrative hook to sort of help. This is another way of dealing with the events of the massacre without actually having to relive the events of the massacre or put you through the event. I wanted to explore it from multiple viewpoints. And I thought the idea of a retrospective written years after the effect would be an interesting idea. And I batted that around with my writing partner who didn't actually help me on this particular book, but we write all the other stuff together. And I had the idea down and I was looking for a title for that book. And he was the one who suggested the 4000 because he knew that I was a fan of The Great Escape, the World War II film, The Great Escape. And the references to the prisoners who were killed in that film by the Germans after they attempted their escape, they're always called the 50 because they were the Gestapo picked 50 of the 70-odd prisoners they rounded back up after that escape attempt and executed them. And they were later tried for war crimes for that. But they were always referred to as the 50. And in fact, the film is dedicated to the 50. And I when he said the 4000, I said, that's the title. That is it right there. That's what I'm going to call it for now and forever. And luckily, everybody else agreed with me. So I just like that idea of stepping back from the events, the immediacy of the events. People have had time to reflect. They've had time to consider their actions, good and bad, you know, as they were involved in those events, and examine it from multiple points of view.
Well, I thought it was a great way to kind of get those points of view. And I love the author in the book. I love how you bring that little girl back in.
Yeah, I didn't come up with that originally. I had a narrative. I had a placeholder. I wasn't really sure who was going to be, but as the girl factored more heavily into the story, I realized that's who the author has to be. And so that informed that last scene between her and Giorgio at the end of the book.
And I'll bring up another character in the book that I thought you did a great bringing him in as we've never really formally met him well before. And that was Captain April. We finally get to see Captain April.
Captain April, in different versions of this event, as it's been chronicled in, for example, the autobiography we were talking about earlier, Captain April and the Enterprise arrive eventually at Tarsus IV in the aftermath of the massacre to render aid. And it's been that little nugget has been included in other iterations of that event. So I decided to stick with that idea, even though I was pretty much instructed I didn't have to take into account previous novels or anything else while writing this. If I wanted to go a different way, I was free to do so. But I like the idea of having April in the book. And then as far as the way he's portrayed, that is based on a characterization that was created by author Diane Carey back in the 80s for a novel that she wrote called Final Frontier. And it was basically a story of George Kirk, who's Captain Kirk's dad, and he works with Robert April on the prototype of the Constitution-class ships, which eventually the ship that they're working on becomes the Enterprise. So that's a bit of 80s pocketbook Star Trek lore. So his mannerisms and his characterization, so the eccentric talk and the cardigan sweater, that's all Diane's creation. And those of us who've written Star Trek fiction since then, whenever we have a reason to include Captain April, we all seem to have unconsciously or without actually talking about it, informally agreed that we're going to honor that characterization of the character.
Well, thank you. I definitely need to look up more details on that book then.
Yeah, it's called Final Frontier. It was published in the 1980s. I think it came out in like 88 or 89, somewhere in there.
Yeah, I remember that book. I read that book. That was a good one, actually. I do remember that one.
Yeah, it was one of the – when Pocket Books was doing the paperbacks, it was what they called a giant novel, a giant paperback. So it was like twice the thickness of a normal paperback. You know, because back then the novels were a little – they were not quite as lengthy as they are today. They were more in the 65 to 70,000 word range, whereas today they're 100 to 125,000. So, but yeah, this would have been that type of day, you know, it would have been thick enough for a trade paperback or a hardcover today.
And the thing that we really just find different from those old pocketbooks too, is the fact that you've got these Discovery writers involved directly with people like you bringing the kind of direct canon to the story, you know? So even if people want to argue about canon, we call a book like yours, and adjacent, because it's
I think mine is the only Discovery book, not counting the one that just got released last week, John Jackson Miller's Die Standing. I want to say that mine is one of only two or three at most that has not yet been contradicted by the show. I'm set 10 years before the show even begins, so I'm pretty safe right now, unless they come back with, you know, a Lorca story or something.
Sure.
And that's just the nature of tie-ins. I mean, it's going to happen, especially with a show like Discovery, where showrunners and writing staffs change between seasons and priorities change about what they want to do with the characters and all that sort of thing. That's just the nature of tie-in fiction. You know, it's going to get, particularly if you're writing for an active property like Star Trek or Star Wars, you know, the chances of you being contradicted by a future episode or film are pretty high, particularly now when we have so much Star Trek in development.
Yeah, I can imagine it's almost impossible. It's like just this big sphere of information that you can't keep it all in one box. One of the things I really liked that you did was you went back and you talked a little bit about both Lorca and Giorgio's previous postings also. You said that like Lorca served for 3 years as a security detachment aboard the USS Helios and 4 years two other starships, and then Giorgio had was apparently set to go to the Defiant, which is kind of interesting given where Mirror Giorgio ends up.
I think I had originally a different ship for her, and then Kirsten asked me to change it to Defiant. I don't remember why offhand, though. I think she was establishing some backstory, and I think it may have been something they just ended up not pursuing, you know, during the course of that first season. But I think I want to say Archimedes or something was what I had in mind, and then she asked me to change it to Defiant, and I'm like, okay, you know, it's all names to me at that point. I just assumed that
I was just going to say you included both. You had both the Defiant and you said that she was aboard the science vessel Archimedes.
Okay, that's what it was. It's been too long.
Yeah, yeah, it's fine. It's been a couple of years.
And I've written so much since then, I've kind of forgotten. But yeah, it must have been a different ship then that she had me substitute for Defiant. And I thought it was going to be in service to something that they might reveal on the show, but it's possible that that got cut when they were writing the script or something, because I never saw it in any script. It was just an interesting way to build backstory. And, you know, this is all stuff that Kirsten signed off on and the show writers signed off on. So at least back then they were okay with this backstory for Lorca and Giorgio.
Very cool.
Yeah, I did notice, though, you had Betazoids
in this book, but they weren't using their abilities.
Yeah, that secret. Was they were secret. They were sneaky, weren't they?
That was the
suggestion from both Margaret and Kirsten. They wanted me to. I was looking for non-human species to, you know, include in the book, and I was kind of limited by what we know of, you know, who was serving in Starfleet at that point in time. But the idea that the Betazoids could be there and just not have yet revealed their abilities was, I don't remember who came up with that idea. It was either Kirsten or Margaret, but, cause I said I could use a Betazoid, but well, how do we get around it? And that kind of thing. And we knew that, Trill, for example, were one option that I had considered. Wait a minute. Am I right? It is Betazoids. But we had considered a Trill because, you know, we knew that Trills were around during that period because Jadzia remarks about how she knew McCoy in medical school, that kind of thing, with a different host. So we knew that the Dax for sure was running around back there in that time frame. But I didn't want to include Dax, and I think they waved me off a Trill for some reason, but I don't recall offhand why. They thought the Betazoid idea so that I could use her telepathic skills, you know, subtly or surreptitiously was what they wanted me to do. So I was fine with that idea. I thought it was a neat way to introduce that species in this era.
It was very clever. It really worked out really well, I thought.
Yeah, there's that scene where the one officer is standing, Jen is standing on one side of the wall, and she says something about, you know, something on the other side of the wall, and the guy's like, what are you, psychic? And she's like, something like that.
Yeah. I may have been too on the nose with that. I don't remember. maybe I trotted just a little too close to the line. I don't.
Well, you know, one of the things I really like about these Discovery books so far, we've only read two. We're going to read the Saru book will be our next one that we're going to read and review. But so far, these feel like episodes. They feel like that you could pop these right into the TV show and just move right along and not miss a beat. They feel that that connected and that interwoven with what we see on the TV, and I really like that they're like that.
Thank you. That is a testament to Kirsten Beyer. She is amazing. I love her. She is very involved in the development of these storylines. She works with the writers, and, you know, to different degrees depending on what's needed or what she wants to convey. She's very invested in the backstories of these characters and making sure that these books ring right. And she's our advocate in the writers' room. So if we come up with something that she thinks is really cool, she'll you know, make a note of that and try to pass it in the room so that the other folks might be aware of it. Whether they take it into account is a different conversation. But you know, she's our support group, our fan club, as far as in the room. And this is the first time that I ever worked on a book for a show that was not only in production, in active production, but also in development for most of the time that I was actually writing my book. In other words, I wasn't working off a couple of seasons of the show already. They were developing the storyline and the characters at the same time I was writing my book. So it was a different challenge for me, you know, because all the other stuff I write, those shows have been off the air for years.
Did you have to change tack off?
Did I have to what?
Did you have to change tack in your book, you know, when something would come out and would influence the direction that you had to take your book?
Nothing major. I mean, it might have just been something like the name of an admiral or something like that. It was very minor. No, I did not. And that was one of the reasons why I liked writing a prequel set 10 years before the show, because that kind of stuff is minimized, you know, versus with the challenges that some of the other folks have had while writing their stories. I very smartly took the chicken way out and went behind everybody by 10 years. I was able to avoid a lot of those booby traps. No, I was fine. It was, she gave a note. She would give me a note about that kind of thing. And I think I had to change an admiral's name. She preferred me to use this particular admiral versus that one because the fate of that particular admiral in the show was going to go a certain way. So I don't remember the specifics, but I remember it was that level of, can you change this because we're doing something different on the show now. That was the extent of it.
I believe you.
Yeah, I thought.
Yeah, go ahead, Jim.
I thought that was really cool that you used the same Admiral. When I was reading it, I actually went back to Discovery. I said, wait a minute, is that Admiral the same one? And it was. And I thought that was pretty cool that you used the same guy that we see later. I thought that was a really neat thing to do.
It was, and I don't remember what, I don't even remember which character it was first, but it was another Admiral whose name I had seen in a script. And I thought, okay, well, this Admiral, this is a cool character. I like this person, but she basically had the same idea just with a different Admiral. I'm like, okay, that's an easy fix. Not a problem at all.
Yeah. It's really, really, really good. Really enjoyable read from beginning to end. So back to the Lorca thing. So one of the things fans are just clamoring for is what happened to Prime Lorca. And we've talked about this on the show based on what we've seen on Star Trek, particularly Deep Space Nine. We know that the characters do not necessarily just pop in where the other one popped out, and that you can have a Prime and a Mirror character together in the same place. We saw it with Mage Kira. So when I saw that part at the end of your book where we see Prime Lorca in the Mirror universe with his fortune cookies, and then I read on the internet an interview with Jason Isaacs, who says that he's in talks come back, and then I read this in the book and I get all excited and think, maybe they're going to do a short trek or something with Lorca, because fans want to know what happened to the real Lorca. And you know, when you wrote this, you already knew that.
I did not know anything about Jason Isaacs coming back. When I wrote it, I set it up because that's the way Kirsten asked me to set it up. And I assumed it was for a reason, but, you know, changing showrunners, changing priorities, Jason Isaacs' availability are all factors into what happens. And of course, they took such a different approach to season two. There just wasn't a room, there wasn't an area for any kind of Lorca exploration. There wasn't going to be one. So I don't know. I honestly don't know if Jason Isaacs will come back. I would love to see him come back because I thought he did such a great job the first time around. And he's such a wonderful actor to watch. So I would love to see a Prime Lorca story of some sort. I don't know what form that would take. I don't know what anybody would want to do with him once they've got him. I'm curious to know what he's been up to. Don't know. Guess we'll find out.
Yeah, I met him at a convention right after we found out he was in the Mirror Universe. And I asked him if he was going to be coming back. And he said, me and my daughter were standing there in a line with a bunch of kids waving Harry Potter wands around, and I'm dressed up as a Klingon. And I asked him, and he says, well, I've been lying to you all along, so why would I tell you the truth now?
Exactly.
Like, yeah, you're right. So
yeah, that's
there
right.
You have it.
I don't know. We might. I've learned to never say never in this business and doing this type of work. We'll wait. It'll show up sooner or later. Maybe. I don't know.
Well, I can't recommend this book enough to everyone who's listening, Drastic Measures. It's a really enjoyable read. There's a lot of twists and turns in it. It fits really nicely into what we know about Star Trek, both TOS and Discovery, and it fills in a lot of the backstory of Lorca. It was great to see Lorca interacting with Giorgio, something that we didn't get to really see on the show, and that was great. And I thoroughly, thoroughly enjoyed it, and I recommend it to anyone that's looking for a really good book to read. How about you, Eric?
Yeah, absolutely. Lorca was the most interesting character for me because, of course, you know, we didn't know much about him, and he seems very emotionally charged. You know, he can kind of get wound up and get, like, passionate about things, which I think is particularly interesting as you juxtapose that to the Mirror Lorca that we actually got in the TV series. Also, there's like similarities and differences in a lot of different ways. So I just loved his character. And yeah, this book was a lot of fun to read. Thank you for, I read it back when it first came out. And then when we decided to reread it, I was so excited because I dug it the first time around. And yeah, good job.
Thank you. we didn't get a chance to touch on it, but one of the things that people have asked me about is, Prime Lorca doesn't really seem to be that much different from Mirror Lorca. The lines are a little blurred compared to other characters who have bigger counterparts. And I came at that from two different things. And the first one was he was able to convince everybody around him that he was the real Lorca for all that time. But then that made me think about the line from Spock in the original Mirror episode, where Spock notes that it's easier for civilized men to behave like barbarians than it is for barbarians to behave like civilized men. So that's why Kirk and his landing party were able to pull off the bluff in the Mirror universe, whereas Mirror Kirk and his landing party were immediately discovered for who they were and immediately taken into custody by Spock, because there was no way they were going to pull off that charade. So I started turning that over in my head, and I realized there probably isn't a lot of separation between these two characters. I'm sure there's a moral difference, like, you know, our Lorca is not going to just kill wantonly. But that's not to say he doesn't have a harder edge than your typical Starfleet officer. And he might be a little bit more grunt, you know, coming from that mindset of, you know, ground troops or security division, where you have to have a harder edge. And then to pile on the personal tragedy from what happens in the book, that would make him a little bit of a Jack Bauer guy, I think, at least for the duration of that story. So I don't know that there's a lot of separation.
The
scene where he's in the interrogation room with Simmons, and
in the outline,
that was a point. It's like, okay, that felt a little like Mira Lorca. He's got that energy of like, I'm gonna lose control. I'm gonna do something to you. And it's like, if Simmons was lucky, Georgia was right there to stop him from doing it.
Right.
But that was a good, hard version of Lorca.
That interrogation scene, and then the end where he's on the manhunt for he's chasing down Kodos, that last bit there. I think I even have in the outline for that latter scene that I think I even have something to the effect of Lorca goes full Jack Bauer. So he's got a phaser in both hands. And I say that because I'm a huge fan of 24, the show. So I totally channel Jack Bauer a little bit in that, particularly I don't know if you follow the show, but at the end of the first season, Bauer is basically unhinged as he's trying to hunt down the bad guy, and he's got a gun in each hand and he's just killing bad guys left and right. I mean, this is long before John Wick came along, and he's just unstoppable. And I thought that there should be a little bit of that in Lorca at this point in the story, because he's so into the manhunt and really wants to bring this guy down.
Yeah.
Well, and that makes me think, project forward from your story a little bit, Prime Lorca could probably do pretty well in the Mirror universe, so to speak.
Maybe. That's a good idea. That's a great idea. Maybe I'll think about
that.
So talking about the Mirror universe and Prime Lorca, in the book there's a scene where the girl, when the girl goes to see Giorgio, and Giorgio's reading the book, and she asks Giorgio asks her about Lorca, and the girl says that she's contacted Lorca several times, and he refuses to talk to her. And you're thinking, well, maybe he's just upset about it. Maybe, you know, he doesn't want to talk about it. But in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, when does he switch? At what point in this novel does the Mirror Universe Lorca take over? Is that why she won't talk to him? Because he's already the Mirror Lorca and doesn't really know anything about it because he wasn't here for it? Or am I just looking too deep into that?
No, you're not too far off. I left it vague on purpose because at the time I wrote that scene, they had not inserted the line of dialogue about that he had been switched while commanding the Baran. And they didn't even really pin down when that happened. Like, they didn't actually list, like, 6 months ago or 3 months ago. Because that was one of the early discussions about this when we were talking, was when I first started to write the outline and we hadn't quite pinned down a story. Like, we hadn't yet landed on the idea of Kodos and Tarsus IV. I was still coming up with ideas. And one of my early questions was, when did the two Lorcas switch? How long has Mira Lorca been in our universe? And I raised that very question about how is he able to pass off as the real Lorca being from the Mirror universe? And I even brought up the whole line about barbarians and civilized men. And that was still a question that had not been pinned down at that point in time. So I kind of just went with it and figured I'll adjust as necessary if they give me any information or if I get something from a script. And it never really came out in any definitive fashion when the switch was made. So I just sort of left that last scene vague on purpose, just to make sure that it didn't get contradicted by a line in the script or something.
No, it worked beautifully, particularly when you get to the end and you read the prime Lorca with the with the fortune cookie thing. And I immediately jumped back to that scene and I thought, well, that's got to be why Lorca didn't talk to her about the book, because it was Mirror Lorca. That's what
right.
I thought, anyways.
And he wouldn't know anything about those events. So yeah, exactly.
He can't
but
talk
it
about
can go either way.
Something he doesn't
yeah.
know about.
That
yeah,
or but the other thing works too.
Yeah.
I want to bring up another good point in this book. Time I listened to it, I immediately, I think that evening or the next day, watched Conscious of the King, the TOS episode. And the story just fit perfectly. It's like, oh, reading the book, that episode makes much more sense because there's the backstory.
Thank you.
I would definitely recommend that anybody reading the book to go back and watch the episode after you've read the book.
Oh, I don't know. That was probably the one place that I really leaned into the episode was the speech that Kirk has him read, you know, the portion of the speech that Kirk has Anton Caridian read. And it becomes obvious that he's Kodos because he doesn't have to read from the lines. He wrote those words. They're his words. And so, but it's a fragment of a larger speech. It's a fragment of a larger statement or a declaration. So I had to figure out how to lead up to that moment in the speech. Like, how do I get to that line of dialogue or that line of the speech and have it feel organic? Like, I basically had to deconstruct his speech to figure out how I was going to write the preamble to that piece at the end where you're telling everybody they're going to die. I'm like, okay, that's about the most, as far as leaning into the events of the episode that I went with, because I just thought that was, at first I thought I was just going to stick with what was known about the speech, what we heard on the episode. And I realized, no, if I'm not going to dwell on the event itself, I have to have this speech we have to have this thing in its entirety to really lay the hammer down about what's going to happen to these people. And so that was fun. It was an interesting exercise in you know, watching that episode over and over again and looking for other things that the character said that I might be able to draw on and influence what the character wrote. It was fun. There were a lot of challenges to writing a sequel or a prequel to that episode, because if you think about it, it's not really something that could happen in reality. I mean, the idea that he got away and was able to disguise his identity, they found a body that, you know, burned beyond recognition. Okay. Yep. They didn't even know what DNA was when they wrote that episode. And now we've had, you know, 50 seasons of CSI where everybody knows about DNA that watches TV now. And so I had to come up with a plausible explanation for how Kodos was able to evade the authorities in the 23rd century when forensics has advanced so much more than what we have right now.
Yeah.
There were some interesting challenges to this book.
Yeah.
And you know what? I was a little bit, when I started reading the book, I was thinking, I'll tell you honestly, I was thinking to myself when I first picked it up, you know, I'm not really sure about this book because we already know the ending. And why do I want to read a book where I know the ending? I know that Kodos escapes. I know that they don't catch him. So I'm reading this whole thing and it's an exercise in futility because they're not going to catch him. Giorgio's going to fail. Lorca's going to fail. He's going to escape. So why do I want to read a book if I already know the ending? But you don't know the ending. it's that good that the whole Kodos thing isn't actually the story at all. And that's what I really liked about this book. Kodo escaping was, I thought you came up with a great way to explain how he got away. He stole the DNA from the computer, and then, you know, the computer was wiped, so no one knew, and blah blah. I thought that was brilliant. But as I read the book, the Kodos thing ceased to be as important to me as it was when I started the book, and I thought that was just a testament to the great writing in the story. So.
Oh, well, thank you. To me, the story is about Giorgio and Lorca. And how these events affected them. So it's the massacre and the hunt for Kodos is a backdrop to that. It's kind of like the same reason we all watch World War II movies, even though we know how that ended, or everybody goes and watches every Titanic movie that's ever come out, even though we all know the ship sinks every time at the end of the movie. My daughter loves that film. That's why I use that as my favorite example. It's like, we all know how this ends. I knew how it ended before I went to go see it. But you know, it's not the destination, it's the journey. So, to borrow some Voyager parlance. Because you raised the valid points. Like, why would I want to read about this? I already know what's going to happen. He's going to survive long enough to be in a middling first season episode of another TV show. No, what this man did and the people who he managed to entice to follow him and go along with this plan and how it affected all the people on the planet and the people who were the first responders. That's the story.
So let me ask you another question. This is a kind of an inside joke that we always have. Whenever we talk about this, we bring this up. Does Lorca have a goatee in the Mirror Universe?
Well, I don't know. That's a good question. I don't know because we never see him in his natural. Well, here's the thing. He shows up in the episodes in the first season, and nobody comments on the fact that he shaved his beard. So
that's true.
Maybe he did not, you know, and not everybody in the Mirror Universe in Discovery had a beard. You noticed that Stamets didn't have a beard and none of the other male characters goatee. I find that to be interesting. But then again, we already knew that because Archer didn't have one in the Mirror Universe episodes. And most of the other characters didn't either. So I think that's just a Spock thing. Maybe that's just
a
signature
Vulcan
move.
Thing. I think Soval had a beard too, didn't he?
Soval had a beard. You're right. You know what? Only the Vulcans had beards.
Only the Vulcans. Yeah.
Even in the DS9 episodes, nobody has beards.
Yeah.
So I think it might very well be a Vulcan. That could very well be.
Yeah.
Well,
it's just an inside joke that we always throw around on the show. The reason why they're so evil is because they got a shave.
T'Pol didn't have a beard, though. So, you know.
No, that's true. Oh, boy. So, Dayton, before we're just about out of time here, believe it or not. So before we let you go, are there any new projects that you're working on that you want to let everybody know about? Anything that you want to throw out there that they can look for? Anything that's coming up?
I have all kinds of stuff I want to talk about. I'm just not allowed to. I am working on a couple of book projects right now, but they have not been announced by their respective publishers, so I can't say much. What I can say is that my writing partner, Kevin Dillmore, and I are working on the third of five short stories that we're writing this year for different publishers. And as we speak, there's an anthology that will be out in a month or so called It Came from the Multiplex, which is all horror stories that are inspired by 80s horror movies. So if you like films, if you love films like The Return of the Living Dead or Fright Night or House or Creepshow, that's the type of vibe we're going for in these stories. So that'll be out in about a month. And then we're writing a couple of anthologies for a couple of short stories for other anthologies that'll be out later next year, late or into next year. So we're just kind of riding the short story train right now.
Fright Night. Chris Sarandon's birthday was just yesterday, by the way. He was in Fright Night. So one of my favorite 80s horror flicks, Roddy McDowall from Planet of the Apes. I just love Fright Night.
I love 80s
Lost Boys.
Movies, period. I'm an 80s guy. I grew up in the 80s. So, I mean, that's my decade for movies, action movies and horror flicks and science fiction. And
they don't make them like that anymore. I don't know.
You can't have our show without mentioning the big one, Nightmare on Elm Street.
That's right, Nightmare on Elm Street. That's right. No running in the hallway, Charles.
Yeah.
Yeah. So before we have to say goodnight to Dayton, you guys have anything you want to throw in before we have to say goodnight?
Just thank you. I love the insight. Can't wait for the Star Trek Adventures book.
Thank you. I can't wait to see it myself.
Yeah.
I can't wait to see it myself.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much for coming on the show, Dayton. It was great to meet you and get to chat with you and ask you some details about the book. And, you know, even though it's a couple of years old, it still is like fresh as a daisy in my head. And I really had a great time talking about it. Thank you.
Well, thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you very much for coming on. I really love the book. And hopefully you get to write another Star Trek book for us at some point. And we can read that and have you on to talk about that one as well. You never know.
You never know. Well, you're a couple behind if you haven't read, if you're just now getting around to Drastic Measures. I've had a couple come out since then. So you'll find a way to get
well,
me back, I'm sure. So.
We used to do a show called Comic Corner, and we reviewed IDW's comic books, and we had J.K. Woodard on a couple of times with us. And then when the COVID hit, they stopped making comic books. So
well, they're back now. They're back.
Yeah, now
they're
they are.
Now,
they weren't for a while.
Yeah.
So
yeah, they
we
were shut
changed
down for a
Comic
while.
Corner into Book Nook and started doing the books. Now Comic Corner is back. So we're going to rotate. We're going to do Book Nook, Comic Corner, Book Nook, Comic Corner, so we can keep doing the books and the comics at the same time. So Book Nook is here to stay, and that's why we're only up to Book 2.
All right. So, well, we'll be here when you get back. So
we'll keep moving along, and we'll catch up with all the books eventually, but we'll get to it. So thank you very much for coming on with us. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it. It was a lot of fun.
And have a really good night. Thanks for being with us.
You too. You guys take care.
Good night.
Bye-bye. You too. So, guys, that was Dayton Ward, the author of the book Drastic Measures, Star Trek Discovery tie-in book. It's a really good book. I can't recommend it enough. And before we get cut off by that nice lady, I want to let you guys in on some really big news that just broke just this afternoon. And you guys are going to be the first ones to – well, actually, Eric and Charles already know it because I told them. But you guys are going to be the first ones to know it right now. I hope that you have some spare time on Thursday night, because Trek Talking is going to have a really spectacular show for you guys. We were going to be talking about Lower Decks and a lot of the news that came out of San Diego Comic-Con, and then my phone rang. And I got a phone call from an agent out in Beverly Hills who represents several Star Trek actors like Chase Masterson, Garrett Wang, Tim Ross. There was a whole slew of them, and the guy was naming them off, and my head was spinning. And when we had Manu Interamy on last week and talked about the movie Unbelievable, they heard the show. And Manu went back and told them, you know, what kind of show we run here. And we're professional and fun and whatnot. So the agent contacted me about having all these stars on our show next week. So Thursday night, we're going to have a Star Trek extravaganza of a show. I don't have the full lineup yet. I don't have any details yet. I don't know if we're going to have 15-minute segments with each actor, or we're going to have three at a time for an hour, or we're going to have all of them on for 2 hours. I don't have any information. That's how fresh it is off the press. All I have is an email confirming it, and as soon as I can get that nailed down as to who's going to be on with us and at what time, I will get that posted on our Facebook page so that you guys don't miss it. But please leave some time on Thursday night from 7:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time to tune into Trek Talk and have your questions ready. The phone lines will be open, and we're going to have a lot of Trek talking to do on Thursday night. I am so excited about it. What do you guys think?
Oh, my gosh. I'm so excited. I'm really excited. I can't wait to see what the lineup is.
Yeah, I don't have any clue at this point in time, but it's going to be fun. I know that. It's always fun when we get together and Trek Talk.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I think the biggest news that we were going to talk about on Thursday, which we'll talk about now because we probably won't get a chance on Thursday, Star Trek Discovery Season 3, the date has finally dropped. And we are going to, it's going to be Thursday night, October 15th, and it's going to run right after Lower Decks. So we are going to have nonstop Star Trek, which, if you guys remember, CBS All Access promised us that their goal was to have Star Trek on year-round, so that anytime you turned on CBS All Access, there would be a new Star Trek episode of something airing, and they're keeping their word. We're going to have two concurrent Star Trek episodes, shows running. We'll finish up Lower Decks, go into Discovery Season 3. Now, COVID is going to put a damper on that because Picard Season 2 is going to be behind, and Strange New Worlds has also been put on hold because of it. So there's going to be a little gap, but they're trying to hold true to giving us Star Trek year-round. This is the first step, so I'm really excited about it.
Yeah. 23 straight weeks of Star Trek.
Yes, just like the old days when Star Trek used to be on in the glory days. You know, well, they took a break in between there back in the old days.
Yeah.
Well, but they had a couple of shows running at the same time, like DS9 and Voyager were running at the same time.
True. So that was going to be our big news for Thursday night, but all these Star Trek stars kind of trumps that, so. That's what we're going to do Thursday night. You guys definitely want to tune in for that one. And, we're down to 3 minutes. So I definitely want to say thank you to Dayton Ward for hanging out and talking with us about his book, Drastic Measures. I'm so glad that I didn't mess that up and call it Desperate Measures. I was worried about that.
Good job.
So I had the book sitting here on my computer, so I didn't make that mistake because I'm old and senile, and that's what I tend to do. But I had the book sitting right here, so I wouldn't do that.
And the nice thing about us being a couple of years behind is that, you know, now we can just read these back to back, and, you know, we may get through several books in a year, and that'll catch us right up. So it was really fun to go back and just explore something from just a couple of years ago. I know he's got these newer ones. I can't wait to get to those.
And we don't have to worry about spoiler alerts either, which is good.
Also
too.
True. Yeah.
So anyways, so I wanted to say thank you to Dayton for hanging out and Trek talking with us. And of course, I have to say thank you to my co-host, Charles. Thank you very much for hanging out with us on Book Nook tonight, Charles.
Oh, thank you. I love talking Star Trek, and the novel just add more to it.
And don't forget the Klingon core book / game expansion as well. I'm excited about that.
Yeah.
I'll have to talk to TJ and have TJ order me up a copy of that. I'm really excited to read that one, too. And, of course, I have to say thank you to my other co-host, Eric. Thank you very much for hanging out and Trek talking with us as well, Eric.
Absolutely. Dayton was so cool, and it was so fun to get to talk to him. So thanks, guys. Another great show.
And Dayton is on our Facebook page as well. That's how I found him.
I did
not know that.
There you go.
He follows us at Trek Talking and Beyond. And all you people out there listening around the globe, make sure you check us out at Trek Talking and Beyond. Spell that all out on Facebook. You can take place with our polls, which I didn't get around to answering. I wanted to bring this up while we had him on the air, and it slipped my mind, where I ran a poll as to which Star Trek novel you liked better, Desperate Hours or Drastic Measures, and 56% of the fans picked Drastic Measures as their favorite book of the two. So, congratulations.
Congratulations.
I wanted to bring that up when he was on. So anyways, I'm Uncle Jim. And make sure you guys tune in on Thursday night for Trek Talking and Beyond. It's going to be a Trek extravaganza. I want everybody to stay safe, be good to each other, and I hope to hear from you all soon on Thursday night. Good night, everybody.
Good night, y'all.
Live long and prosper.
Can we go already?
Yes, fine.
Engage.